Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interest, to understand why they are doing so. Because ultimately, exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes and schemers isn't hateful. It's the most caring thing we can do. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means teaching and instruction, guidance, not law, because it's liberating, and its empowering and enriching covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. Anytime over the next 3 hours, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, you can call toll-free 877-300-7645. Most of you may know that I took a vacation last week with my family. I want to thank IQ Al-Rasuli, who did a great job on Friday, as IQ always does. He is the world's foremost expert on all things related to Islam. I also want to thank James and his lovely wife, Patty, who did four programs for us. The first on circumcision, the importance of circumcision, in that it is the most divisive aspect of Christianity from the Torah, based upon Paul's writings, where Paul is overtly opposed to circumcision. And Yahweh says, that's your choice. You don't have to be circumcised. But if you're not, as a male, you can't participate in Passover, which means you're going to die at the end of your mortal existence. There'll be no eternal life. You cannot participate in the covenant, which means you can't have a relationship with God, and you're expressly excluded from entry into heaven. So while it's your choice, it's pretty clear that Yahweh, which is God's one and only name, and Paul, who is the founder of the Christian religion, are at odds with each other over this issue. Paul even went as far as to say that if you're circumcised, you can't be saved. God said exactly the opposite. He also did a program on Passover, which we will celebrate on sundown, Sunday evening, April 13th, followed by Unleavened Bread. His final program was on the merits of unyeasted bread, and I want to thank James and Patty for those shows. And lastly, but not least, we had two programs from Larry, one with of those with William on the Torah and its translation. No one is more passionate about getting the Torah right, getting what God said correct, so that we can know and understand who he is and what he is offering than my good friend Larry. And William, our mutual friend, is just an extraordinarily passionate and clear communicator of the merits of the covenant. I want to thank all of you. I heard in the news today that there are people, probably Christian fundamentalists, who are having a conniption fit that some school children were served non-alcoholic beer. It was done all in a interactive setting to help underscore the importance that beer played in the advancement of civilization. I can't help but comment on this. Of all of the things poisoning our children today, politics, religion, drug abuse, an incredible array of disgusting pastimes. Broken homes. They're concerned about non-alcoholic beer as it relates to the development of civilization. I mean, what on earth is wrong with people? The fact is, folks, that without beer, there would be no civilization. The first monetary systems were developed because of beer. The first legal codes were developed because of beer. The first attempts to record information in writing was developed because of beer. Man went from being a hunter-gatherer to an agricultural-based lifestyle and developed communities because of beer. Had there been no beer, civilization could not have developed because you couldn't drink the water around a large concentration of people. It is that simple. Beer is an extraordinarily important part of civilization. And, you know, if schools, rather than indoctrinate, would actually teach history, and to use events like the development of beer to teach mathematics, which was developed because of beer, to teach economics, which was advanced because of beer, to teach legal systems, which were developed because of beer, to teach science in terms of organisms and how pathogens grow and develop in water because of, and how that is eliminated through the brewing process, both with boiling water initially, as also the development of alcohol to preserve it. So much can be learned, and it could be an interactive learning experience that goes across all segments of what is necessary for students to actually understand. A real-world setting. And rather than say, yay, they're actually teaching something where this child's mind can be expanded and they can see the benefits and how all of the various aspects that we consider learning, reading, you know, with written language, science, mathematics, how they're all developed through beer. What a wonderful way to make it real for these students. And yet, what do the parents do? They throw a conniption fit. Well, at least according to SRN, which is the religious news of the morning. Now, while I was gone, folks, how is it? I'm not claiming that I have any control over anything, but y'all lost an airplane. I mean, you didn't just lose an airplane. You lost a 777. It has a wingspan of 200 feet. It's 209 feet long. It's 61 feet tall. How do you lose an airplane of that size? I mean, you didn't lose a Cessna Putt-Putt. This airplane carries up to 400 passengers. This particular one had 227 passengers and 12 crew members aboard. It's an airplane that can carry, in addition to the 400 passengers, 5,300 cubic feet of cargo. The extended range version produces 93,000 pounds of thrust, the largest engines ever strapped to a moving object. Even with these Rolls-Royce engines, which are the most antiquated of the engines available on that aircraft, this airplane can fly using a payload of 45,000 gallons of Jet A, 7,725 nautical miles. I mean, that's 8,800 statute miles. You think that over a course of nearly 9,000 statute miles, somebody might have picked up a glimpse of this airplane on radar? I mean, come on, folks, how do you lose a 777? Yes, there's word that someone turned the transponder off. Okay, well, there's all sorts of automated reporting systems that can't be turned off, including the emergency locator beacon, including the engine diagnosis reporting. Yes, I understand that somewhere along the way they say that someone turned off the system that provides that telemetry to the ground. They call that system the ACARS, but goodness, you know, why would anyone build one of these airplanes, giving the pilots the ability to turn that off? All that does is provide useful information if something is failing in the aircraft. And after over a week of this airplane being gone, we're told that, well, we've narrowed down its location. It's in a region of 7.7 million square miles. It could be, and we've got this pretty much down now, anywhere from about Afghanistan to Australia. It could be in Vietnam or Madagascar. It could be in New Zealand or Turkmenistan. It might have crashed in the Indian Ocean or be floating on the Caspian Sea. And the best you've all got after more than a week of this airplane being missing is that the pilot of Malaysia MH370, Zawri Ahmad Shah, was obsessed with politics, and that he was obsessively supportive of a convicted sodomizer who was the lead opposition politician. Or the co-pilot, Farik Abdul Hamid, who was more interested in pretty girls than flying, that they turned off the transponder, they turned off the ACARS data transmission systems, they reprogrammed the flight management systems, they turned 90 degrees back over Malaysia, and then vanished. Don't China and the United States spend hundreds of billions of dollars spying on everything that moves? How is it, under those circumstances, that y'all could lose an airplane? While I was gone, CNN did a very long investigative piece on its military suicides, veteran suicides. It's called The Uncounted. The title was extraordinarily promising. The title suggests, as I suggested here about 2 weeks ago, that the death toll for the American invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq is not 7,000 as is reported, but instead over 250,000. And so the title tells us that there is a huge number of returning veterans who have committed suicide and should be counted in the overall death toll for the ill-fated, counterproductive invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. But perhaps not heeding the math lessons in school, perhaps not really understanding the meaning of journalism, they were unable to get beyond the 22 suicides a day that are reported. So when we return after the commercial break to Shattering Myths, we will review the math and share that it's not 22 per day, but many more than that. To Shattering Myths, before we get to the math of the uncounted, and before anyone sends me stories saying, how could you make fun of a story as horrible as the disappearance of a jetliner with 239 souls aboard. I mean, folks, you do have to admit that losing an airplane is a rather odd set of circumstances. During the break, I had the opportunity to speak with Aaron, who produces this show, and I asked him, since the Genesis Communication Network is rife with conspiracy theorists, if there was a conspiracy theory as to how the airplane disappeared. And he shared one with me, and I don't think Aaron will mind if I share what he heard.
No, not at all, but I would like to throw out that was not said by anybody on our network. That was just something I came across online while reading about it.
Okay, and go ahead and share it. What was the favorite all-encompassing conspiracy theory of what happened to this airplane?
The most entertaining one was that Vladimir Putin has somehow taken over the aircraft remotely from the ground and then flew it up to a high enough altitude that when he depressurized the cabin, everybody inside would then die. Then remote control the aircraft to Russia to have it painted and then later shot down to make it appear that the U.S. has fired upon a Russian aircraft.
Perfect. I can't imagine the conspiracy buffs wouldn't love that. I mean, it's got an airplane being shot down. It's got an airplane being disguised. It's got Vladimir Putin as a villain. It's got remote control of airplanes. I mean, this is right up the alley of the 9/11 conspiracy fans. There is a couple of things that are absolutely obvious in this disappearance, and we'll go back to the uncounted. The ACAR system that was disabled on that aircraft, to even know how to disable it would take goes beyond even the training of a pilot. Pilots are not trained how to disable reporting systems. And that particular reporting system can't even be disabled from the cockpit. So it took somebody with extraordinarily inside information as to how that airplane is designed to know how to disable the automatic data reporting system. That particular system, it's a system that was so helpful in the Air France aircraft that crashed over the Atlantic off the coast of Brazil, when it showed that the pilots reacted foolishly to a errant readings that they were receiving in cruise flight at altitude after they had flown either through or right around a thunderstorm. They, first of all, you should not fly an aircraft through a thunderstorm. But beyond that, that system showed that when the pitot tubes froze over because the amount of moisture and cold moisture in the thunderstorm overwhelmed the heating system of those pitot tubes, which receives ram air from the leading edge of the aircraft's wing, typically is where they are, but not the nose of the fuselage of the airplane, and reports airspeed and is used also in conjunction with other instruments for the altimeter. These guys in that Air France plane, based upon the automatic data that was transmitted, we came to know, pulled the nose of the airplane up, as opposed to pushing it down and recovering from the stall. They essentially stalled the airplane and, you know, it became a rock. Well, the last thing that anyone in their right mind would want is that system disabled, because that system tells you exactly what happens. If you don't find a black box, that system will tell you exactly what happened on the aircraft, including if any part of the airframe or engines or anything else malfunctioned. But beyond that, we know in this particular situation that the pilots didn't just turn the airplane from the FMS flight path that had been entered on upon takeoff, but actually reprogrammed the FMS for GPS data waypoints. They didn't just turn it from FMS on the autopilot to heading bug and turn the heading bug 90 degrees from north, northeast to west. They programmed GPS waypoints. And I'm going to tell you, an FMS, a flight management system on a jet aircraft, is not intuitive. You're not going to learn how to program one of these and entering the GPS waypoints by watching a YouTube video. This is something that the pilots of that aircraft had to do. So it you don't have to go very far to figure out who did it, why they did it, and where they ultimately took it. Now, that's an entirely different story. Now, when we return to Shattering Myths, we will return to the math related to the uncounted, because it may be the single biggest story, at least in America, on this day. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. To their credit, CNN has produced a very compelling, at least from a human interest point of view, perspective on the uncounted war dead from the Afghanistan and Iraq invasions. It's a story that desperately needs to be told. The death toll from these two invasions, both of which were counterproductive, both of which left America much more vulnerable, both of which turned bad situations into almost infinitely worse situations, both which grotesquely increased the prevalence of terrorism. Neither of which can be justified under even the most convoluted reasoning. We're so horrible. The mission was so misguided. The truth was so non-existent. Moral goodness non-existent. That Americans who have returned, who witnessed this misguided military adventure, are taking their lives in record numbers. The invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, rather than just being 7,000 total military fatalities, are actually over 250,000 military fatalities. It's the third most costly war in terms of lives in American history. It's followed only by the Civil War and World War II. Far worse than World War I. Far worse than Korea and Vietnam combined. Over 250,000. Now, let's do the math. The CNN began the story with the headline that 22 returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans take their lives every day via suicide. Well, that number is accurate, but only in the sense that that represents the number of veterans from states that represent only 40% of the U.S. population and only approximately 70% of those in those states who take those lives. In other words, yeah, 22 per day in states representing 40% of the U.S. population with even those states only reporting 70% of the actual veteran suicides. That's the number. But it's not the number of American veterans returning from Afghanistan and Iraq who are taking their lives in aggregate. You know, since it is public knowledge that only 40% of U.S. states, or states representing 40% of the U.S. population, not any of the largest states in America, report veteran suicides. You have to begin by the recognition that 22 per day has to be divided by 0.4 to make it a number that is consistent with all of America should every state report veteran suicides. I know math is no longer taught as it should be in schools. In fact, over my vacation, I had a discussion with a PhD candidate over multiplication tables. I said, you know, why are they no longer taught? You know, why are we allowing children to become dependent on calculators? Because if you can't do multiplication, division, if you don't have a concept of what the numbers comprise, the relationship between numbers, you really are precluded from thinking rationally in many cases, because so much is based on probability and likelihoods. Or, in this case, what is the actual number? And they can't divide 22 by 40%. Wouldn't even know how to begin. But folks, the answer is 55. And then you have to realize that every report that's been done on the number of veteran suicides is saying that even in those states that represent 40% of the U.S. population that do report veteran suicides, they're only reporting approximately 70% of the suicides in those states. So now you've got to take 55 and divide it by 0.7. No, the math is 79 per day. It's not 22 per day. More than three times that number. It's 79 per day. But why stop there? You know, it's not hard to multiply 79 by 365 days per year. And then the number is stunning. It's 28,855 veteran suicides every year. And then all you need to do is to say, all right, how long have U.S. vets been coming home from Afghanistan and Iraq? You know, we invaded, what, over 12 years ago. They've been coming home for over 10 years. You multiply 28,855 by 10, and you know the real consequence, the real death toll of those conflicts. It's in excess of 250,000. Now, some would say that there may have been some of those individuals who, even if they had not participated in the military, had not, in the case of women, been raped, in the case of men seeing grotesque atrocities perpetrated by their fellow soldiers, which they had to hide for risk of being demeaned by other service members, that there might have been some of those that would have committed suicide even if they hadn't gone to Iraq. Well, that's probably true. But how many more killed themselves through deliberate recklessness that aren't counted as suicides? Whether they tried to replace the thrill of battle, of going out on a hunt where the hunter is also the hunted, with thrill-seeking, with brawling, with drugging or drinking themselves to death. It is an interesting study. I think it is probably the most important unreported story of our day. That the real consequence of the ill-advised and counterproductive invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq cost America 250,000 lives of its children. And the devastation that that has brought to their children and to their spouses, as well as to their parents. Speaking of military abuse, the one of the most important stories is the fact that the sexual abuse in the U.S. military is at epidemic levels. The least safe place to be a woman today is in the U.S. military. The safest place to be a rapist today is in the U.S. military. So the day that I left, a brigadier general, Jeff Sinclair, was to begin his trial at Fort Bragg for sexual assault. The general was accused of adultery, of violating orders, of conduct unbecoming an officer, of forcing his girlfriend of nearly 3 years to perform oral sex, of abusing the government's credit card by taking sojourns, we'll call them shorties to use the military term, to go visit his mistress. He was also charged with threatening to kill his victim and members of his victim's family if she snitched him out. He was scheduled to begin his trial the day I left on vacation. He is no longer being tried. No. This is a man who is married with two children. He's acknowledged that he had a consensual, adulterous affair with his accuser. Now, adultery is a crime in the U.S. military. And that his accuser is an Army captain 17 years younger than he is. He was willing to accept punishment under military law for adultery and retire from the Army, but he began to fight the other charges, including threatening to kill his victim and his victim's family. The 51-year-old Sinclair faced a maximum sentence of life in prison. He stood to lose his pay and benefits while he was abusing the U.S. taxpayer and abusing women under his command. But he was a real hero. You see, he had 5 overseas combat deployments, and he had won 4 Bronze Star medals. Genuine hero, this Sinclair. He was the deputy commander serving in Afghanistan with his girlfriend when she reported their relationship in March 2012. Well, he's pled. You see, the defense claimed that the President of the United States, when he made a statement, he says, listen, sexual abuse is so epidemic in the U.S. military. It's such a problem in the U.S. military. It's so out of control in the U.S. military. And the U.S. military is only prosecuting a scant 1% of its sexual predators. That the president said, you know, these individuals ought to be stripped of their rank. They ought to lose their pensions they ought to be ousted from the military. Well, because the U.S. president spoke generally about how horrible not only sexual abuse is in the U.S. military, but even worse, how the victim is victimized further by the military, where the actual rapist is coddled and very seldom prosecuted, that those statements by the President of the United States in general, they say, poisoned the opportunity for this sexual predator, Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair, to not only have a fair trial, but to plead his case effectively. And so after the proceedings had begun, this judge said, oh, why don't we have a revisitation of pleading? And he was convicted only of adultery and misusing the government's credit card. Not for sodomy, not for threatened murder, no, not for sexual assault. Something seriously wrong with this picture. We'll return in a moment. The article that was one of many that I surveyed regarding Jeffrey Sinclair. This is Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair's charges of sodomy, of sexual abuse, of threatening to kill his victim and his victim's family, said that with Sinclair's rank, the ongoing controversy over whether the military is sufficiently punishing predators of sexual assault will be closely followed around the country, if not the world. Less than 1% of the sexual predators in the U.S. military are convicted. Less than 1%. Hey, this is an environment where it is really easy to be able to demonstrate sexual assault. Now, you've got a hierarchy that puts junior officers and enlisted at a disadvantage over senior officers and the rank system. You've got people's whereabouts typically constrained to a specific area. You've got immediate access to them. You've got their DNA. I mean, you could not be in a stronger position to prosecute sexual offenders than in the U.S. military. It doesn't get any easier than that. And yet, less than 1% are convicted. The system, of course, is turned upside down because in the U.S. military, it's a boys' club where boys have their own legal system. We need to eliminate all military jurisprudence. Sexual assault ought to be charged in civil courts under the same rules that apply in civil courts. No good old boy, well, he's a general, we don't want the black eye now. I mean, the abuse scandal, sexual assault scandal in the U.S. military is worse than the pedophile scandal in the Roman Catholic Church. And the cover-up by the U.S. military is worse than the cover-up in the Roman Catholic Church. And yet, the judge and the military jurisprudence allowed this man to plead once his trial had begun. It's stunning that we continue to play this game, that we continue to wave the flag patriotically and celebrate the military, thank them for their service, when it's the single most dangerous place to be a woman in today's society, and it's the single safest place to be a rapist. Now, of course, Sinclair's lawyers have suggested that he is the victim of an jealous ex-lover and an overzealous prosecutors facing pressure from top military and political leaders to send a message that sexual misconduct will not be tolerated. There's no question that he was engaged in sexual misconduct. There's no question that he took he's even admitted to using his general's army credit card to go fly off to have sex with a junior officer. this is a black and white case. There is no defending this man. And yet, he was allowed to plead. Military commanders now decide whether a defendant will even be tried, which is why less than 1% of sexual predators in the U.S. military even face trial. And they can overturn a conviction if they think that the jury made the wrong decision. We need to eliminate the JAG system. We need to eliminate military trials. And simply prosecute military criminals in civil courts. You can't have a military so rife with sexual assault. They have at their disposal the absolute most deadly weapons man has ever conceived. And these men that you now know are not trustworthy. These men who are getting away with all manner of abuse are able to wield these weapons. There's something desperately wrong with this situation. We have Glenn having called in from Philadelphia. Glenn, I don't know if you want to talk about the story and amongst the missing airplane or this scumbag of a general, but we have, unfortunately, heard the music. We're going to go into our top of the hour news and commercial break, so I'm sorry for getting to you so late, Glenn, but if you can hang on, we'll talk about these and other stories when Shattering Myths continues after the quick break.